is a zoo, and inside the zoo are all kinds of exotic animals. And it's really quite amazing, like, just how exotic the animals are that live in this zoo of networks. So the very first type of network are lattice networks. So this is what you might think is familiar, like a square lattice. I draw something like this. Or a triangular lattice. I draw something like this. And then the hard part is to make it not turn into a Kagame lattice, but square lattice, triangular lattice. And the thing about these guys is that they're boring. The point is that once you see one plaquette, one elementary unit, then every other elementary unit is the same as the next. So to paraphrase the words of Ronald Reagan, one of our presidents from a while ago, who was referring to redwood trees, if you've seen one plaquette, you've seen them all. So they're not terribly interesting. Redwood trees. He said, if you've seen one redwood tree, you've seen them all. That's why he wanted to have clear cutting on the redwood forest, except for a thin swath, like 20 yards on either side of highways. Yes. Anyways, he was a true environmentalist. The next type of graphs that I mentioned a little bit yesterday are trees. And you know, there's all kinds of trees. There are Cayley trees, in which you start with a single link, and then you branch out, say, in threes, and then each of the threes branches out in threes, and then it continues branching out ad infinitum. And this turns out to be a very useful model for mean field transitions. There are random recursive trees. Random recursive trees, which I spoke about yesterday, and I'll say more about today. And then there's also branching processes. And this is a classic problem from the late 1800s, the so-called Galton-Watson branching process. And I forget who was first, but the question was the following, that if you look at the names, last names of family names in England, what's the chance that Smith is going to become extinct? Or what's the chance that Llewellyn Smith will become extinct or last forever? And the idea here is, in a random branching process, is that you start, say, with a name like Smith. And Mr. Smith has three sons who are all named Smith. But this Mr. Smith doesn't have any sons for some reason. This guy has two sons. This guy has only one son. And then at the next branch, maybe this guy doesn't have any children. Maybe this guy doesn't have any children. So, you know, grandson Smith is the one that's the family name is, like, crucially dependent on. And maybe he has only one son, and this guy decides not to have any children, so Smith is dead. So the point here is that in the random branching process, you say that at each vertex, one branches into some random number. And then it turns out that the statistics of this branching process is incredibly rich. And so I'm just giving you at least a definition of these models so you have a taste of what kind of things exist. Another thing is the Erdős-Reni random graph, ER graphs. And so these are graphs in which you just randomly link anywhere any pairs of points. And the thing about the Erdős-Reni random graphs is the existence of a percolation transition. That was an outstanding feature of it. Another outstanding feature of the random graph is that they are so-called small world. I'll have more to say about that in a second. What I mean by small world is that the distance between any pair of points is small. Typically, these things have a diameter that's proportional to logarithm of the number of nodes in the network. So if you think about a lattice network, if it's an n by n network, then the distance between arbitrary pairs of points will scale as a power law in n. But for Erdős-Reni random graphs, it only scales like log n. Yes?
Is this very dimension dependent?
Well, the way I've defined the Erdős-Reni random graph, there's no dimension inside of here. There's just points which are living in any dimensional space, and you just connect them randomly without any regard to where they are. And so dimension plays no role.
What do you mean by diameter?
Diameter, so what I would mean is a number of hops that you take to get from one node to another. So if I imagine that each link has length 1, I ask how many hops, and that would be a definition of distance. Now, the thing is that these Erdős-Reni random graphs have cousins. One can have regular. Well, let me write it this way, degree regular. So we saw yesterday that for Erdős-Rényi random graphs, the degree of each node was distributed by a Poisson distribution. One can put some further restrictions on the nature of the graph and get all kinds of interesting animals. And one of them are the so-called degree regular graphs, where you force every single node to have the same degree. So they have a feature of the lattice that every single node has the same degree, but they're still random. Another type of graph is planar graphs. And these are really bizarre animals. So what do I mean by a planar graph? Is that I have a collection of points, just as like in the Erdős-Rényi random graph, and I connect pairs of points. I do this, but I never allow something like this. I never allow links to cross each other. So I have the planarity constraint in building up these planar graphs. Yes?
Are you allowed to move vertices after they've been initially placed so that you can?
Well, you know, this now depends on like the algorithm that you're going to use to construct such graphs. But depending on how you actually construct a computer algorithm, yes, you can, but it's not terribly, you know.
To be clear, the thing you've drawn so far right now is a planar graph.
Yes. 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 I mean, I haven't finished yet, so I need to do something like this and maybe like that. That hopefully.
Nope, still planar.
Still planar. Hopefully that's not planar. No?
Nope, still planar.
Okay, I think I've killed, no, maybe I haven't killed planarity yet.
Just draw the K
what?
Graph.
What?
Just draw the K graph, and no, that's not planar.
What's the K graph?
It's the one with the star that's coming
up. You know more about it than I do then. But anyways, I mean, yes, unfortunately I failed to draw a planar graph, because if I moved this site over here, then all of these links would have gone away. I mean, all of these crossing points would have gone away. But hopefully it's clear what I mean, that I can't draw it easily, but a planar graph is one in which when you connect up all the points, there's no crossing of the links. Now, an amazing thing about planar graphs is that if you go back to networks, you'd say, these lattice networks, if I ask you, what is the spatial dimension of these networks, you'd say what? Not a trick question. What's the dimension? D equals 2. Correct. I go down here for planar graphs, I ask, what is the dimension of these graphs? Trick question now. What is the dimension of planar graphs? Does somebody know the answer? What?
1.5.
No? No?
Like the triangle. I mean,
you can draw the Sierpinski triangle with a planar graph. So it seems like we can.
But no, but the thing is that the Sierpinski triangle is a very special planar graph. If I look at the ensemble of all possible planar graphs that I can make, and for the ensemble, what?
Oh,
no, that's for the Sierpinski gas log 3 over log 2. But for the ensemble of all planar graphs, the dimension is 4. It's mind-boggling. So what do I mean by dimensionality of the graph? Is that I take, you know, I have a collection of points that are then connected in some way such that the graph stays planar. And one way that you can measure the spatial dimension is that you can look at the number of points in a circle of radius r. And so you can define n is proportional to r to the power d. And in so doing, as you imagine making your circle larger and larger and counting points, if in a planar graph, clearly, as I make a circle and make it larger, the number of points scales like r squared. So d is obviously 2. For random planar graphs, it scales as r to the power 4.
What do you mean by expanding a circle in a radius? I mean, we don't have a notion of.
Well, so, OK. I mean, I'm being a little bit sloppy here. But let's suppose that every single link has length 1. And I then connect them with a planar graph, and then I make the radius larger, then I'm going to get that the number scales as r to the power 4th. So this is a really weird animal in your zoo. You know, it's kind of like the platypus. It sort of is, you know, it's got a little bit of mammal, it's got a little bit of duck, you know, it's got a little bit of everything in it. I'm coming close to the list then of my list of interesting graphs. But you know, the thing is that I'm only sort of scratching the surface. So here's number 4, our random walk type graphs. And what I mean by random walk type graphs is that people have done a lot of work, as you can imagine, in studying properties of random walks on any kind of a network. And a basic question that you might ask is, what is the so-called commute time on a graph? That is, you take a pair of points on the network, you ask for a random walk on this network in which there's no spatial bias. How long does it take to get between any pair of points? So in one dimension, if I have like a large ring of size n, the commute time in a large ring is n squared. Because, you know, we know that diffusion is the radius scales like t to the 1/2, so the time to scale to travel a distance of the order of r goes like r squared. But it turns out that you can construct things like this. This is an attempt to draw a complete graph. And then I have a long chain of size n. And then another complete graph, so this dumbbell. And here I have, again, a complete graph. And it's n nodes here. And here's n nodes. And then you can ask, on this object, how long does it take for a random walk to go from one side of the network to the other side? It goes like n cubed. And mathematicians have spent a lot of effort in trying to figure out what are the networks that have the largest commute times, the shortest commute times for a given value of n. And so you get these weird types of graphs that are a mixture of linear chain and very, very dense. I think these are called expander graphs. What? Oh, OK. Yeah, again, I'm just sort of giving you a little tour of the first couple of hundred yards inside the zoo. The next type of graph I just want to mention briefly is so-called small world networks. And so this is a formalization of the small world property that appears in the Erdős-Reni random graph. And the small world network is only introduced about a decade ago. And the idea here is to, for example, you could have a linear chain that you make a periodic boundaries, and so you make it into a ring. So every single pair of points has two neighbors. And if you have a finite number of neighbors, a finite degree, such a graph is called sparse. And it's also a large world, because it, you know, if you're over here and you want to get to over here, then you've got to go distance n. And so what Watts and Strogatz came up with is to put in a very small density of very long-range links. And it turns out that if you put in an infinitesimal density of long-range links, the network can still stay sparse, but the diameter of the network, where you define diameter as a number of hops between connected sites, can suddenly change to becoming small. So by small world, you can get sparse, but small. And then the last type of network, which has now been the focus of, again, a very intense decade of effort, are the so-called scale-free networks. And so these are networks in which one focuses on the behavior of the distribution of degrees. And in scale-free networks, the distribution of degrees is broad. And so again, in the framework of the whole story of networks, it's like, you know, we learn that there's mammals, there's fish, there's platypuses, there's whatever. And then we find, after studying these things for 150 years, that there's another animal that we never saw before, like in some hydrothermal vent deep in the Pacific Ocean. There's some new animal. So a lot of physicists, myself included, got very excited about this. And so what I'm going to be talking about today is primarily about scale-free networks. Yes?
Last night, that this paper about small world networks was like one of the top most cited papers in physics in the 1990s. So I read like a lot of applications of that kind of thing.
Absolutely. I mean, the very first one, first of all, is the World Wide Web. It's that if you look at the structure of the hyperlinks, or you know, how the internet itself is routed, but hyperlinks, I think, is better. You know, you get, it doesn't take many clicks to get any place in the world. That's one simple example.
And like, to physics.
Pardon me? Oh, to real. Well, what do you mean by physics? Well, you see, now we are coming to an issue about like what do we define as physics? Because if you think physics is like something that's in a lab and it's under a microscope, you know, you should have a larger picture of what you think physics actually is. Because social networks, you know, you have people that are doing some simple interactions. You can think of them as atoms, and they have some simple interaction. And so instead of looking at the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution of colliding atoms, are looking at the, you know, interactions of people that have maybe a slightly more complex Hamiltonian, but I would call that as physics as anything else. But in fact, this is a vigorous debate in the physics community, and some people, some deans in my university included, say what you're telling me is bullshit, because that's not physics. Physics is like you're in the lab and you're doing some real condensed matter system. Anyways, okay, so with that preamble, now I want to go back to my transparencies and build on what we did last time about the uniform random recursive trees. There we are. So let me just remind you what I did yesterday. So we talked about the random recursive tree, which was one of the animals in the zoo, and it was a particularly simple animal because you could solve all of its properties exactly. And so let me just remind you what it's doing. So here it is. We start with a single node, and we build it up in the following way. One by one, nodes come in. We pick a node. We introduce nodes one at a time. Whoops, I'm on the wrong one, I guess. And so we attach to an earlier node uniformly and randomly. Unfortunately, this is going to repeat because I started on the wrong slide. And so the basic thing you want to calculate is degree distribution. So here it is. This is what I meant to do for today, which is just it was going to scroll through without stopping. Anyway, so you'll get a double dose of like how this object works. So what I want to just remind you again, one thing from yesterday was the equation for the degree distribution. And so I wrote down yesterday this master equation. Where's my stick? And you know, again, I want to try and emphasize like how useful this master equation approach is here, because the same tools that I've been discussing all throughout this past 2 weeks applies here. And so one can compute how the number of nodes of degree k changes each time I add a new node. And there's a gain term, a loss term, an input term. And then I showed the tricks about how you might solve this easily by applying the scaling that the number of nodes of degree k is equal to a density of nodes of degree k times total n. And if you make that ansatz, you get a trivial recursion formula that any high school kid or even grade school kid should be able to solve. One gets a degree distribution 2 to the minus k. So these networks are not scale-free because the degree distribution is very sharp, but they're going to be a prelude to understanding the real thing, the scale-free networks. So let me now introduce scale-free networks. And I'm not much of a biblical exegete, but nevertheless, let's go to the Bible because it tells us something very important, something called the Matthew principle. So I'm not much of an expert on the New Testament, but so here we are, Matthew 25:29. For unto everyone that hath, which means they have something, shall be given. So if they have something, they'll get more. And he shall have abundance. So if you got a lot, you're going to get more. But from him who that hath not, shall be taken away, even that which he hath. So if you got nothing, it's going to get taken away from you. What? That's capitalism. Maybe. Another way to say this is the rich get richer. And what I want to do now is to apply this rich get richer principle in the framework of complex networks. Because if you think about how networks grow, in the random recursive tree, networks just grew uniformly and randomly. But now let's think about the World Wide Web. And in the World Wide Web, there are hyperlinks that you, the user, can create to link to somebody else. So what is the probability that any of you are going to write a hyperlink to my website? Probably not, because you know I'm just some random physics professor in the United States. Who cares about me? But might you make a link to Google or to New York Times or to you know Facebook or to your favorite one of these collaborative computer games that you play? Much more likely. So the thing is that I don't have very many students linking to me, so I'm not going to get very many links. But the New York Times or Google or something else will have lots of links, and they'll get more links. So I want to just now apply that idea in building up a network by using preferential attachment based on the degree. So if I have a node of degree k in a network, I will attach to it with a rate that's proportional to k to some power gamma. Now, the case that made a lot of fame for the person who came up with it was k to the power 1, linear preferential attachment. And what I'm going to show here with this master equation approach, that one can solve arbitrary gamma with equal facility by the master equation approach. So let's now work on this. So this is a so-called preferential attachment networks. And maybe some of you have heard the name Barabasi and Albert. They wrote a paper in 1998 that appeared in Science magazine. It's probably been cited 4,000 or 5,000 times now. It's just, this area was just absolutely white hot for a period of time. And Barabasi went from being a nobody to really somebody. And in fact, he was a graduate student at BU. So it's like I knew him as just a graduate student, and, you know, he's eclipsed everybody in our department. But the thing about him, which is interesting, is that he's a very clever and shrewd person. And so he came, it's one of those things, when you come at the right time, at the right place, with the right idea, this stuff was in the air in the late 90s. I mean, one could feel that something big was brewing. And he was the one who was just at the right place at the right time. Because the thing is that the basic idea underlying this preferential attachment networks actually comes from a guy named Yule, who developed a model to describe the abundance of species. And then later on, another 30 years later, Herbert Simon came with the same type of model to describe word frequencies in language, and actually he solved the preferential attachment model. But I don't know if anybody has heard of the name Herbert Simon. He was an economist. He won the Nobel Prize in Economics in 1995 for work he'd done like 50 years before. He was a guy who was very much an iconoclast, and he was typically 40 or 50 years ahead of his time. So this paper in 1955 that he kind of, you know, was just lost from the sands of time was not rediscovered until around the year 2000. And so the thing is that, you know, Simon should have been Barabasi Albert, but he wasn't, just because it was at the right time, it was at the wrong time at the wrong place. So, you know, sometimes luck has a lot to do with how things go. Anyway, so let's now look at the preferential attachment network. And what I'm going to present to you is the master equation approach. So at least there's a smidgen of advertisement for our work by Kropinski, Lavra, and myself, and Kropinski and myself. And there was another group in Portugal that did more or less the same thing at the same time. So what I want to do now is I hope that the tools of the master equation are looking enough familiar to you that you know, you'll follow along fairly easily with what's going to happen next. So I want to now calculate how the degree of how the number of nodes of degree changes each time I add a new node to the network. And so this looks very similar to the master equations for the random recursive tree, but there's a little bit of a tweak to incorporate the fact that each node, its attachment, the attachment rate to each node is not independent of the node identity, but it depends on its degree. So let's focus attention, for example, on the loss term. So in the loss term, I'm going to lose a node of degree k if I attach my new node to a node of degree k. And that way, I'll create one node of degree k plus 1, and I'll have lost a node of degree k. And so the rate at which I attach to a node of degree k is this attachment rate a sub k. And I can attach to any one of nk nodes of degree k. So ak nk is the total rate that I'm going to attach to a node of degree k. And then I have to divide by the total rate of attaching to anywhere in the network. And then this ratio is going to be the probability of attaching to a node of degree k. And if I attach to a node of degree k, I lose the node of degree k. And so that's why it comes with a minus sign. And remember that for the random recursive tree, I had essentially the same thing, but there wasn't any ak sitting out in front. Similarly, there's a gain term, because I can attach to a node of degree k minus 1. And so I attach at the rate ak minus 1. And then ak minus 1 times nk minus 1 is the total rate of attaching to any node of degree k minus 1. I then divide by the total rate of attaching anywhere. And I'll write down what total a is in just a moment. And so this term here is the probability that a new node attaches to a node of degree k minus 1, thereby increasing the number of nodes of degree k by 1. And finally, there is the input, where we're always inputting nodes of degree 1 at each stage of the game. And so we have this extra term here. So this is the master equation. And if we're dealing with this so-called degree preferential attachment rate, then the total rate of attaching anywhere is just the sum over every single node of the network, the rate of attaching to a node of degree j times the number of nodes of degree j. And so this is what the total A is, a total attachment rate. Now, one thing to emphasize here about how to deal with these sorts of networks is notice that for degree preferential attachment, AK is K to the gamma. So if I plug that into here, I'm going to get the number of nodes of degree J times J to the power gamma. This you can think of as a moment of the degree distribution. And so I'll define this thing to be the gammath moment of the distribution. So for example, if J was 1, I'd have just the average degree of the network. If J was 0, then I would just count the total number of nodes in the network. But in general, we can look at any moment of the distribution. And as we've seen in the case of aggregation kinetics, for example, sometimes if you can't solve for the complete distribution of masses, you can get some partial information by looking at what is the average mass, the mean square mass. These sorts of partial pieces of information are then useful in trying to get the solution to the full problem. So what I want to do now is solve this master equation. And the thing about the solution to this master equation is that it's embarrassingly easy. You're going to see that I don't have to work very hard to solve for everything. And that's what's, I think, very handy about the master equation approach, is that when you have the right theoretical framework, problems become easy. And again, let me try and emphasize, coming back to the Erdős-Reni random graph, which when it was first studied looked like a very complicated problem. And if you look at the papers that have solved the Erdős-Reni random graph, they're really high-powered mathematics. But when we recast the Erdős-Reni random graph as a dynamical evolving problem, then somehow we got a lot of information with almost no work based on things we've solved in the past. So an important issue here is that in these problems of complex networks, if you think of just staring at a static picture of a complex network, it looks complex. But it had to have been built from somewhere. And so if you build up from the very beginning and have some simple rules of how it grows, then even though it looks complex to the eye, because of the simplicity of the underlying growth rules, one can usually unravel its structure. OK, so let's, again, pretend we're studying aggregation kinetics, where I said that, well, maybe it's difficult to solve for the full distribution, but let's look at equations for the low order moments. And in the case of linear preferential attachment, there are two things we know with essentially no work. The zeroth moment of the distribution, which would be j to the power 0, which is 1, times nj, it's time derivative. So the over dot here is meant to represent time derivative. But for this problem, there's no time. The only definition of time is capital N, the number of nodes in the network. So time is like the number of nodes. So how does the total number of nodes change with time? Well, by construction, every time you add a new node, you increase the number of nodes by 1. So the time derivative is exactly equal to 1. So that's really easy. Even I know that the solution to this is m0 is exactly equal to n. Similarly, if I look at the first moment of the degree distribution, this one is a smidgen more difficult, but only a tiny smidgen. So the first moment is jnj dot. And so what is jnj? First of all, this object can be thought of as the average degree of the network, because j is the number of stubs coming out from a given node. And if I sum up over all nodes, I'm going to get the number of stubs at each node, which is just the total degree of the network. Now, the thing is that because of the way I've built the network, every single link is in either one stub or another stub. So when I count the total number of stubs, or if I ask how does it change, each time I add a link, one link will increase the number of stubs in one node by 1 and another node by 1. So I'm increasing the number of stubs by exactly 2. So every time I add a new node to the network, the first moment changes by 2. Because these equations are so trivial, you know what the solution is. M0 is proportional to capital N. M1 is proportional to capital N. And now we can make a very modest conjecture, which is that if I look at the total attachment rate, which is the gammath moment of the distribution, if gamma is between 1 and 2, that means it's between this and it's between that. And in this one, n, the zeroth moment grows like n. Here, the first moment grows like 2n. So we can make the modest, meek, the meek statement that a sub n is proportional to n with a coefficient that lies between, this should be between 1 and 2. This is a mistake here. This should be from gamma can be between 1 and 2. It should be between these two limits. Furthermore, as we saw in yesterday, if I look at the degree distribution itself, if you were to solve the equations one by one, tediously and laboriously, but it's not so hard if you're solving for n1, n2, n3. You don't want to do it for n99 or something like that. But for the first few, you'll see that each one of the degree distributions is, again, proportional to capital N times the density. So let's make that ansatz. And now I'm going to plug this ansatz into the master equations and see what comes out. Yes? Oh, I'm sorry. I was looking at mu. Sorry. OK, fine. Yeah, so you're absolutely correct. I'm interested in the case where gamma is between 0 and 1, because that will then lie between these two limits. The point is that this number mu will lie between 1 and 2. Thank you for correcting me.
So why do we want it to?
No, it's just that's an outcome. If gamma is between 0 and 1, that means that this object, which is the gammath moment, is bigger than the first moment and less than the second moment. So it means that the amplitude has to be between 1 and 2. OK. Anyways, now let's take these ansatzes and plug it in to our original master equation. So that's what this is. And then I plug in. And so on the left-hand side, dnk by dn is just little nk. So that's that guy. Here, on the right-hand side, we have, for example, nk, which has a capital N in it, and capital A, which also has a capital N in it. And so the capital N's go away, and we end up with converting a differential equation into an algebraic equation. And notice that it is a recursive relation, that if I have n starting with n1, I can compute, because notice like the equation for n1, there's no n0, so this doesn't exist. So you have a closed equation. n1 is something that you can solve directly. Once you have n1, you can solve for n2, because n2 involves n1, which you solve for. n3 involves n2, and so on. So you can solve these one by one. This is a high school problem of just doing a recursion. And so the exact solution of this equation is that. So there we are. We've solved the entire problem. There's only one slight difficulty with saying we've solved the entire problem, is that this formal solution, and again, it's just like two lines of algebra to go from here to here. That's why I'm not showing it. The problem with this formal solution is that it's a form of an infinite product. It's not very apparent what's going on. We have to extract the asymptotic behavior out of it. So I'll spend now some time doing that extraction. Yes?
Two questions, actually. One, okay. I'm a little bit confused as to what mu is here.
So mu is at the moment an undetermined amplitude. And so if I go back, oops, sorry.
No, I mean, I know you said, but I didn't quite.
Yeah, so mu was the amplitude of the gammath moment. So again, the zeroth moment has amplitude 1. M0 is equal to n. M1 is equal to twice n. So a of n, which is the gammath moment, is going to be some number times n with a number here that's between 1 and 2 that we have to determine. We haven't determined it yet. I'm going to show you how to determine it in about 2 minutes.
The other is, what about gamma larger than 1?
I'm going to come to that, too. We're going to study the entire zoo of animals that come out for all positive values of gamma. And other people actually study negative values of gamma that I think are terribly unphysical, but people have done it. Anyways, so we have our formal solution. So what I want to now do is extract, first of all, mu, which was part of your question, and then look at the asymptotics. So first point is, how do you calculate mu itself? And so here one has to do a little bit of, like, I call it Carl Bender type mathematics, is that we're going to have to write a self-consistent equation for mu. Notice, what is mu? Remember, by the definition of the total rate, if I take ak capital NK, that was the total rate. And that was mu times n. So ak times little nk is just mu itself. So if I take the nk's, which I found formally from here, sum up over all k times ak, then it's all equal to mu. And so I plug this in to the sum, and then you see that you get a self-consistent equation for mu. And what we do know is that mu is equal to 1 when gamma is equal to 0. So down here, gamma equals 0, mu is equal to 1. Mu is equal to 2 when gamma is equal to 1. And we expect it's going to go smoothly between these two limits. And so what one can do is do a perturbation analysis on this side or on that side. And if you do that perturbation analysis, you can calculate as to whatever order you want to. And you find the correction terms. And numerically, one can calculate this smooth curve. And so that's sort of the dorky technical part of this derivation, because you need to know this number to then calculate the degree distribution in full detail. But now let's come to the fun part, which is to extract the asymptotics from this ugly-looking product. So I want to now take this formal solution. And the thing is that everything now is buried in this value of this preferential attachment exponent gamma. So let me now maybe go back here to the blackboard for a minute. So we have this attachment rate, a sub k, is equal to k to the power gamma. And in this particular case, we're going to worry about any value of gamma which is larger or equal to 0. So inside of here, the answer of what this degree distribution looks like is buried in like unraveling what this product does when I plug in a sub j as j to the power gamma. So let's now look at what might be called the universal case. I'm first going to study the case where gamma is less than 1, so-called sublinear preferential attachment. And so how did I, so the, first of all, the answer is e to the k to the 1 minus gamma. That's a major factor in here, which is an exponential-like decay, but with an exponent in the of an exponent in the exponential, which is less than 1. So this usually goes by the word stretched exponential decay. E to the minus k to a fractional power is called stretched exponential. So it's slower than exponential, but it's faster than any power law. So that's the form of the distribution. But now let me show you how you derive that very easily. And you know, if you haven't seen this trick, it's one. It's a very handy-dandy trick to calculate to go from here to here. So let's just do that part. So let's look at what nk is. So I'm going to be a little bit sloppy and not worry about overall factors. So mu is just some number, but I have an ak downstairs. So ak downstairs is k to the minus gamma. And then I have this product. Product 1 plus mu, let me write this way, mu j to the minus gamma. And this product goes from 1 up to k. So there's a very standard trick that allows you to analyze products like this in a very simple way, which you write this in the following fashion. K to the minus gamma, write this as e to the summation logarithm 1 plus mu j to the minus gamma. So when I exponentiate, then e to the, you know, the product of e to the log of the something becomes just e to the sum of the logs. The next step is then you replace this sum by an integral. When I'm interested in the limit of large k, then I can replace the summation by an integral. Another point is that I can also expand the logarithm. When I'm interested in a large k limit, the argument of the logarithm is 1 plus something small, so I can then expand this. And so what I'm going to get in the next line here is k to the minus gamma e. Oh, sorry, there's a minus 1 over there. I start with a minus 1 here. So when I put that in the exponential, there's a minus sign over here. So I have e to the minus, the integral up to k. I'm integrating dj mu j to the minus gamma. And so when I integrate this thing, I'm going to get k to the minus gamma e to the minus k to the 1 minus gamma. And so what you see then is e to the minus k to the 1 minus gamma divided by k to the power gamma. And so this little trick, if you haven't seen this before, it's very useful, it's very handy, and it's used all the time in looking at asymptotic analysis. So one other aspect about this result is that this behavior holds over a wide range of gamma values. In some sense, this might be considered the universal behavior of this style of complex preferential attachment networks. Let me now go on the other side. Let's go to gamma larger than 2. And here what happens is you end up creating what might be called the Bible. And what do I mean by a Bible? It means that one node has such a high you know, if one node gets a lot of stuff, if gamma is larger than 2, the preferential attachment is so much biased towards the richest guy that everybody gives the richest guy money and nobody else has any money. And so, or another way of putting it is if I'm citing other papers, one paper is cited so often that all I know what to do is just cite that one paper and nobody else gets cited. So you end up, even in an infinite network, that one node has all the citations and everybody else has basically no citations. So let's see how this Bible comes about, because again, it comes about by a very simple mechanism. So let me show you how you create a Bible. So here is a network in which you've built a Bible. So if I think now in the framework of citations, here's the Bible. Newton cites the Bible, Leibniz cites the Bible, Euler cites the Bible. Everyone's very religious. Everybody's just citing the Bible and nobody else. So nobody cites Newton because everyone just reads the Bible. Leibniz, you know, he doesn't cite Newton. He just cites the Bible. Euler, he doesn't cite Newton or Leibniz. He just cites the Bible. Everybody is turning to religion. You're just citing the Bible. And so the question is, let's now continue this process. How, as I've gone up and made n nodes in my network that are all studying the Bible, what is the probability that one more guy is going to cite the Bible? And so I use the preferential attachment rule. I have a network that has n nodes. There's n plus one nodes. There's n nodes around the ring and one node, which is the Bible itself. And I want to ask, when I add one more node to the network, what is the probability that I'm going to attach to the Bible? So the thing is that this node has degree n. And so I attach to it with a rate which is equal to k to the power gamma, which is n to the power gamma. And I have to divide by the total rate of attaching anywhere. And every other node has degree 1. So the rate of attaching to any one of these nodes is 1. And I have n such nodes. So the total rate of attaching anywhere in the network is n for attaching to the leaves of this tree, and plus n to the gamma for attaching to the Bible. So that is the probability that the next node attaches to the Bible. So now we can ask, what is the probability that a Bible actually exists? We want to have that Newton cited the Bible, Leibniz cited the Bible, Euler cites the Bible, I cite the Bible, you cite the Bible, it goes on forever. So we want to have that the probability of attaching to the Bible when I make a product over every single node of the network is non-zero. If the probability is zero, then we don't have any Bible. So what we want to do is we want to calculate the probability that a Bible exists. So here was our probability that at the nth step we create a Bible. Let's divide through by capital N to the gamma, and then for the nth step, I'll get the Bible probability is 1 divided by 1 plus n to the 1 minus gamma. And then I have to take the product over all nodes of the network. And this product has a very simple form, quite amazing. If gamma is larger than 2, it is not 0. So there's a finite chance that as you build an infinite network that has the form of this tree, that everybody cites the Bible and nobody else gets cited. On the other hand, if gamma is less than or equal to 2, the probability of citing the Bible is 0. So let me now show you how you derive, go from here to here. Because it's exactly the same trick as I did over here. And it's useful, again, if you're not familiar with these tricks, at least see them in action because they're so useful and so powerful. Yeah, please.
Then why did you write down that for n sub k in the gamma greater than 1 case, we had Bible? I mean, what happens on the ring?
Okay. It's like I paid him to ask this question, because what I'm doing is I first study the case between 0 and 1. Bigger than 2 is simple. And what's tricky is what happens between 1 and 2 and exactly at 1. So I'm bracketing the behavior, and I'm going to come to between 1 and 2 next.
Sorry, they're not.
No. Perfect question. It shows that you're on top of it. Anyways, let's first of all calculate the Bible probability. And so hopefully you know you're going to help me do this calculation. So I want to calculate this Bible probability, which is product from 1 to infinity of 1 plus n to the 1 minus gamma to the minus 1 power. What should I do next? E to the log, exactly so. I'm going to convert a product into a sum. Thing is, we don't know how to deal with products, but we know how to deal with sums because we can turn them into integrals. So let's write this as e to the sum of the logarithm of 1 plus n to the 1 minus gamma, and the minus 1 here becomes a minus 1 here. And now hopefully it's clear what to do next. We're going to change the sum to an integral because this integral is going up to infinity. And we're interested in what happens for large n, so we'll turn it to an integral. And by the way, is asymptotic to. And so here I get e to the minus integral up to infinity dn, and expand the logarithm, and I'm going to get n to the 1 minus gamma. And so you see that everything depends on the value of gamma. If gamma is larger than 2, then the integral to infinity dn n to the 1 minus gamma is less than infinity. And because you have a finite number here, you have e to the minus a finite number, and you get a finite number which is bigger than 0. But if gamma is less than or equal to 2, then this integral to infinity dn, n to the 1 minus gamma, is equal to infinity. It diverges. And e to the minus infinity is 0. And that's why you get the two different results that happen here. OK, so we've bracketed. We found this behavior for gamma between 0 and 1. We found Bible behavior between 1 and 2. And now what happens between 1 and 2? Well, at this here, all I can say is that, first of all, I don't have a good name for it, so I call it bestseller. What I mean by bestseller is that there's still one node that is very, very well cited, that has a finite fraction of all citations in an infinite network. But some of the other guys, Newton and Leibniz, maybe some people actually refer to them because the Bible is just not so overwhelming. And it turns out that the mathematical details of this bestseller phase are extremely rich, and there's a whole infinite series of phase transitions that happen here that's, if you're really into it, I can tell you all the details, but for the purposes, I think, of this setting, just suffice it to say that there is something which is Bible-like, but not perfect Bible, because some other people do get cited in this region. And so let's now focus attention on what I would consider to be the interesting part, which is gamma equals 1. And in this case, one gets power law behavior. So here we had a distribution which was falling off faster than a power law. In this region, we had a distribution where nodes of small degree, their distribution decreases rapidly with degree, and then one node has run away, basically an analog of a gelation phenomenon. And right in the boundary between these cases, we have a power law distribution. So if you remember in aggregation kinetics, we talked about the gelation transition. Pre-gel, we had an exponential degree distribution. At the gel point, there was a power law distribution, which meant the birth of an infinite cluster. And beyond the gel, one had an infinite cluster occurring. So the same phenomenology appears to be happening here. One has a pre-gel regime with a rapidly decaying distribution, post-gel, where one has a singularity, and right at the singular point, there is a power law degree distribution. Now, again, there's a philosophical lesson to be stated here, which is that presumably in Kadanoff's class, you learned about the universality hypothesis, and it got drummed into you that things were universal and short-range details didn't matter. You applied the renormalization group, and everything was cool because you didn't have to worry about any details, and you had universal behavior. So it turns out that these complex networks are exactly the opposite to that dogma. And so when this was first found, it's like people found it very discombobulating because you learn that, well, you know, you have a system, a scale-free network. You have nodes of all possible degrees. And how could it possibly matter tiny microscopic details in the model? And it turns out here that it matters in a fundamental way. So it turns out, and I'll show you in some detail how this comes about, that the degree distribution is a power law, but the exponent of the power law can be anything as long as it's bigger than 2. And if you remember from equilibrium stat mech, you learn that there's universal exponents. They can be categorized, and you know they can be calculated. So this is just the opposite. The exponent can be freely variant. Yes?
Then what determines it? Because presumably, if you have a graph, it has some exponent.
I am just about to answer how we calculate this exponent.
I'm trying not to.
Oh, no, it's wonderful that you asked these questions. It's just like, I didn't have to pay you to ask these questions. That's what I'm impressed about. OK, so now let's spend some time now trying to unravel what's going on here, because this is truly the interesting case. And so what I'm going to do now is, before I solve the case of linear preferential attachment, I'm going to show you a little game that gives you a sense of like what is the origin of linear preferential attachment. Because when the idea of linear preferential attachment was first formulated, yes, question.
Here you assume that A was proportional to or was equal to U times N from the start, and that's how we got the equation at the top.
Right.
But that came from assuming that gamma was less than or equal to 1.
Right.
So how do you know that all your stuff for larger gamma is incorrect?
Well, certainly what I proved for the Bible, the Bible phase. For this one, I haven't shown any details. And if you were willing to like suffer through like 3 or 4 transparencies, I would show all the mathematical details. And I could prove that there's still the analog of one node that has a finite fraction of all nodes.
So you let go of that equation at the top and modify it a bit for different.
Yeah, so what's happening from here and below doesn't fit here. I mean, this is a separate calculation. From here and below, all of that still fits with that. Okay, so what I want to show now is that, as I was saying, that this notion of linear preferential attachment, it's a very attractive idea. You know, you think, well, in the World Wide Web, a popular node is going to be linked more often. If you write a popular paper, you're going to get more cited because you're just popular. If you're already rich, you're going to get more money because people want to give you money when you're rich. And if you're poor, they're going to steal money from you. So that seems very natural. But what I want to show is that there's another very natural way of getting linear preferential attachment from a small modification of the random recursive tree. And it turns out to actually play some role in understanding the correct or the optimum way of vaccinating a population if you don't have very much vaccine. So, you know, we all got our H1N1 shots, or some of us did. But suppose there wasn't very much vaccine floating around, and you wanted to be as effective as possible. What should you do? And so what's going to happen now is going to give you a sense of what you should do. So I'm going to now go back to the problem of the random recursive tree, which is uniform attachment, plus this little thing called redirection. And it's as simple a construction as you can imagine, but it has some profound consequences. So let's imagine we have some kind of a network. Here it is. And let's build it by random recursive tree or uniform attachment plus redirection. And so what do I mean by that? So here's a new node. And what he does is that he picks a random target. So this blue target is picked randomly and uniformly from every single node of the network. And now what I do is the following. With a probability 1 minus r, I attach to that initial target. So that's just the good old random recursive tree. If r was equal to 0, I would just have the random recursive tree. But here comes the kicker, which is that with the remaining probability r, I attach to the father or the mother of this node. So I go to the ancestor, and I attach to it. So here's the ancestor, and I attach with the probability r. So the rule is, first of all, very simple. And by the way, for those of you who do any kind of numerical simulations, as you could well imagine, there was a large industry of people trying to build simulations of complex networks. And for linear preferential attachment, you have an ensemble of nodes, and you want to attach each one with a probability which is different. And that type of process is a process which grows logarithmically with the number of nodes in the network. And it turns out that this redirection rule is, first of all, it's a very trivial rule. It's an order one rule for each new attachment. And as you're going to see, this redirection ends up giving rise to linear preferential attachment. So this method is also incredibly efficient at generating large networks. So back in the days when people were studying networks of size 10 to the fourth and, like, you know, burning up their supercomputers, with this method, you can build networks 10 to the eighth, 10 to the ninth, and not take any time at all. You can do it on your laptop. Yes?
Do you nest, so what, do you have probability of going two steps up, or is it always just the immediate ancestor?
Here I'm just doing immediate ancestor. But interestingly enough, people have worried about all kinds of variations on the scene of going up the ancestor tree or going anywhere in the ancestor tree, and all kinds of weird things come out from that. And so you learn something about the genealogy of these trees by going up the ancestor tree. Okay, anyways, let's just continue a little bit further here. So the point is that we can now ask, what was the probability of attaching to this red node? In order to attach to this red node, I had to initially, by the random recursive tree rule, attach to one of the children of the red node. And so if you happen to have lots of children, then you're more likely to be touched by this redirection probability, by this redirection process. So if either you have a lot of friends or you have a lot of children, depending on how you want to use the description, the rate at which you attach to an ancestor node is proportional to the number of upstream neighbors, which is basically your degree, because your degree is a number of upstream neighbors plus one downstream neighbor. So here we are getting an attachment rule which is effectively linear preferential attachment. So the only thing is that because there is this one downstream node, it's linear preferential attachment with a little shift. And as you'll see in just a moment, this little dorky shift of one turns out to have profound effects. And again, it's one of these things that lies outside of the whole dogma of equilibrium stat physics, where you learn things are universal, short-range details don't matter. Here they matter in a fundamental way. Okay, so I want to now write down the master equation to describe the evolution of this process. So we've seen the master equation for the random recursive tree. And what I'm going to show now is that the same technology can be applied to do the random recursive tree with redirection. So there's a little cartoon here that's going to go along with the master equation that's about to appear. So here is the initial process. With the probability 1 minus r, I'm just doing the random recursive tree. So with the probability 1 minus r, everything else that's inside of here was exactly the same as the random recursive tree. It's exactly that same equation. However, with a probability r, so there's an r sitting out in front, then I attach to the ancestor. And what is the rate of attaching to an ancestor node? It's a number of its upstream neighbors, which is exactly its degree minus 1. So with a probability r, you get linear preferential attachment, but with a shift by 1. So instead of having a k nk here, one has k minus 1 nk. So this is the master equation for this composite random attachment plus redirection. Now, the thing is that you can then just combine the two terms here and combine the two terms here, and these terms combine trivially, and you end up, you end up with an uglier looking equation. But the crucial point is that notice that the coefficient in front of nk is linear in k, but with a shift. So this is where you get this so-called linear preferential attachment. But this ak is linear plus a shift. And what I'm going to show now, is that this tiny shift, so this is like a number, say it's like a half, for example. And so you might imagine that if I have linear preferential attachment in which I attach to a node of degree k, and the attachment rate is k plus 1 half. So if I have a degree of a node of degree 1 million, who cares if the attachment rate is 1.5 million or 1 million? That's a very small change. But as I'm going to show, this little dorky shift actually changes the form of the degree distribution in a profound way. Okay. So, anyways, I think I've skipped something. So let me just, I skipped a detail here because there was this equation that we had. Let me just write it down over here. So we had some kind of an equation that was like nk. Oh boy, let's see if I can even remember it. It was something like this, mu over ak product j equals 1 to k of 1 plus mu over aj inverse. Is that correct? Someone's taking notes? That's correct. Okay. Okay, anyways, so the thing is that let's suppose that ak is exactly equal to k. Then we're going to get that nk is equal to mu over k product over all j. And then I have here j plus mu inverse. And the thing is that when j is an integer, and by the way, and when k is equal to, sorry, there's one more thing here, because mu is equal to 2. So here is 2, and here is 2. And so if you just write down this recursion formula, most of the terms are going to cancel because, for example, you're going to get 2 over k. And so let's write the first term. So it's going to be j is 1. So we're going to get 1 over 3. That's the first term. The next term with 2, so you're going to get 2 over 4, 3 over 5, 4 over 6, 5 out of 7, dot, dot, dot. And we go all the way up to like k minus 2 over k. I hope I did it right. No, sorry. The last term is k divided by k plus 2. And if you start looking at terms cancel, this cancels that, cancels this, cancels this, this cancels this. There's a telescoping product. This cancels that. And you're left with k. And so let me find, I can't cancel this. 2 times 2 is 4. So there's a 4 from these guys. And if I add the next, keep this second to last term and the third to last term, I'm going to have that this k cancels that, and I'm left with a k plus 1, k plus 2, k plus 1, k times 4. So I get exactly that. So in the case of exactly linear preferential attachment, it's actually kind of a pleasant game with this kind of stuff to calculate the exact degree distribution. Now let's put in shifted linear preferential attachment. Now my crutch is here. I didn't have it before. So anyways, the thing is that the point is that when there's a shift, when you write down this recursion formula, now you have, for example, j plus lambda sitting here, j plus lambda, and here you have mu, and there's a mu down here. The crucial point, though, is that in the case where it was perfect linear preferential attachment, the difference, you know, these are all integer values, and so you could just cancel them trivially. In the case where lambda, where there's this little shift lambda, then these numbers in the numerator and the numbers in the denominator are not integers. But this is where the technology, the gamma function, is incredibly useful. And it turns out that this recursion formula, you can write exactly in terms of gamma functions. And gamma functions, did you have any of that from Carl Bender's class? Something about gamma functions? Okay, so if you're comfortable with gamma functions, the thing is that gamma functions have some really wonderful properties. And one of the most wonderful of these things is that if you ask what is the limit of this object as k goes to infinity, because we're interested in the limit of large k, then it turns out there's a very beautiful formula. Let me just write down sort of a generic way of writing it. If I have gamma of n, let's write it k plus a divided by gamma of k plus b limit k going to infinity. But this thing is just going to k to the a minus b. It's a very handy-dandy formula. And so similarly here, you just do the same thing, and you have a is lambda, b is 3 minus plus 2 lambda, and you get a degree distribution, which is k to the minus 3 plus lambda. So if you compare it to linear attachment, here we have asymptotically 4 over k cubed. Here we have k to the minus 3 plus lambda. And so we see that this little dorky shift shows up in the exponents of the degree distribution itself. So this is, I would say, a really surprising element of this process, because it's so counter to what we've learned in equilibrium statistical mechanics, where details didn't matter. Here, the details matter in a very profound and fundamental way. So Dennis, I just want to ask, when should I stop today? Because we started more or less, I think, on time. No, I don't remember when I started. Whenever, okay, fine. Okay, well, so let me just very briefly mention one other thing about these scale-free graphs, which is, I think, kind of cool, and that is to look at the diameter of the network. As I mentioned, you know, back down here when we were talking about number 5, small world graphs that were sparse but still small world. So you might ask, for these scale-free graphs, what is the diameter of the graph? And what I want to show you again is that with the right geometrical perspective and the master equation approach, we can calculate the diameter kind of almost in a pleasant game. So what I want to do is, let's take a particular realization of a graph, and from this, let's build this genealogy. And so here's how I build the genealogy, which is that by construction, the very first node is like this root of the tree, and so I'll call it generation 0. Everybody who attaches to node 1 is in generation 1. So node 4 is in generation 1, node 2 is in 1, node 6 is in generation 1, node 8 attaches to 1, node 9 attaches to 1. But then 3, 7, and 5, they all attach to nodes in the first layer, so they're by construction in the second layer. And it turns out that in terms of this genealogical structure, one can learn a lot. So let's now look at, again, the nodes in the first generation, the nodes in the second generation, and here they are. And so you see there's a simple correspondence we can make. And using this picture, we can now calculate the diameter of the network with essentially no work. So I want to ask, what is the size of the gth generation. So you see the first generation by construction has size 1. Here we have size 5. Here's size 3. How can we calculate the size of a given generation? And what I'm going to write down is even simpler than a master equation, just a rate equation for the average size of the generation. And so how can the gth generation grow in size? So I want to ask, every time I add a new node to the network, how does the size of a particular generation grow? Well, clearly, if I want to ask for the second generation, how can I produce a new node in the second generation? Well, if I'm going to study the case, let me first study the case of random recursive tree or uniform attachment, where I'm going to attach every single node equiprobably. So to increase the size of the second generation, I've got to attach a node in the first generation. And what is the probability of attaching to a node in the first generation? It's the size of the first generation divided by the size of the entire network. That's the probability I'm going to attach to somebody in the first generation. So we get a simple rate equation that the gth generation changes at a rate proportional to the size of the generation below divided by n. So that's it. And the thing is that this rate equation, it has a trivial solution. And I'm not going to show you the details of this, but I'll leave it as an exercise. You can just solve one by one, and you get L sub g has this form. And the thing about this form is that for small g, it's increasing. And then for large g, eventually this wins out, and it's decreasing. And so one can estimate the diameter of the network by saying that initially, if you think of this genealogical tree structure, you start with somebody at the root of the tree. Here are the children, the grandchildren, the great-grandchildren. And typically, the size of the successive generations is getting larger. But eventually, you get to the end of the network where the size of the successive generations is getting smaller. And when the size of the last generation is of order 1, you've reached the end of the network. You've used up all the nodes. And this gives you a measure for the diameter of the network. So if I say that the last generation has size 1, it defines the last generation. And so since we plug in LG equals 1 into here, and we find that the maximum generation is of the order of log n. And so the diameter of the network would be, if, for example, here, if the last generation is 2, then the largest diameter, the longest path, would be you have to go all the way up to the root here to meet your cousin, for example. And so the diameter is twice e log n. So that's what happens in the case of uniform attachment. For linear preferential attachment, you might say, well, this becomes much more complicated because I've got to now attach to every single node with the rate proportional to its degree. But now we can use the redirection trick in a very simple way. And so here it is, which is that suppose that I want to increase the number of nodes in the gth generation, say g is equal to 2. And so here is the equation. And let me give a little animation that sort of illustrates what's happening with this equation. So for example, I can increase the number of nodes in the second generation by attaching to a node in the first generation that happens with the probability r. But with the probability, I'm sorry, I said with probability 1 minus r. But with probability r, I attach to a node in the second generation. This would give me a third generation person. But then by redirection, I redirect to the father, and I go back to the same generation. So I get 2 terms. And the thing is that this equation structurally has the same behavior and the same asymptotic behavior as the previous equation. And so you get the same type of behavior. And so one gets the size of the network scales like log n. So anyways, I have 3 more slides to show. And so here is kind of the moral of the story. I hope I've given you sense, actually, throughout this entire 2 weeks, that this master equation approach is a powerful tool to analyze all kinds of non-equilibrium statistical physics problems, and in particular, complex networks. Complex networks is a beautiful problem to play with because there's a wide range of animals that live in the zoo of complex networks. And in particular, preferential attachment networks are extremely rich in their properties. And we can understand much about their properties by this master equation approach. Now, let me come back to one thing which I kind of left hanging, which was like, where does linear preferential attachment come from? And so let me tell you, so I'm going to spend maybe 3 minutes saying something from my own research. And in fact, it's a little bit of an embarrassment because I like to think I'm a serious scientist. And, you know, I've written some papers and, you know, whatever. But I wrote a paper about 15 years ago, no, not 15, 11 years ago, on citation networks. And in fact, unfortunately for me, it's my best cited paper, and so it's like, I feel like it's almost a joke. But anyways, let me tell you how this comes about. So let's look at the distribution of citations in physical review. And so this is just a little bit of a more historical story. So as you may know, how do scientists rate themselves? One way they rate themselves is by looking at their citations. So, you know, I want to come up for promotion. How much has Redner been cited? He's been cited only 5 times, no tenure. So people now look at citations seriously. And the other thing about it, which is almost a bit of a Pandora's box, is that because now the data is available electronically and easily, everybody can go to the Web of Science. You can look me up on the Web of Science. You can see how many papers I've published, how many citations I have, what is my H index. Everybody knows this kind of stuff now. But let me show you something amusing about Physical Review, which is the largest physics journal. I mean, it's the main premier physics journal in the States, and it has all of its citation data available electronically for the past 110 years. And so what I'm plotting here is the attachment rate for the Physical Review citation data. And so the way that this data is generated is that I took all papers that were published. Let's just focus on the black curve, because all the others are the same. Take all papers that were published between 1893 and 1999. So that's about 350,000 papers. For each paper, I can count how many times each paper was cited. And then in the year 2000, I then ask, what was the probability that I cited one of these previous papers as a function of its number of citations? So the y-axis is the number of new citations each paper gets in the year 2000 as a function of the number of citations it had in the past. And the point is that most of the data is down here, because notice here is 200 citations. It's really unusual to make a paper that has more than 200 citations. So all the data which is out here is just like the most exceptional papers. And all the PhysRev data is sitting down here. And you see that there's linear dependence out here between 0 and 200 citations. So what does this say? It says that a paper is cited at a rate which is proportional to the number of citations. It doesn't care, is it a good paper, is it a lousy paper, was it written 100 years ago, was it written last year? It only depends on how many citations it has in total is going to tell you what is the rate of citations it's having now. And this is actually kind of an amazing thing, because you might say, how do I cite a paper in physical review? If I'm working in statistical physics, I'm not going to cite a paper in cosmology, even if it's very popular. I'm going to look at papers in my own field, and maybe I might look at a paper and maybe include a reference from the reference list of that paper. But if you try and think intellectually how you cite other papers, it's definitely not an intellectual process of linear preferential attachment. I do not say, OK, I'll look at all 350,000 papers in physical review, and I'm going to cite with a probability proportional to how many times it's cited. I'm going to look at the papers in my field, and the ones that are relevant to this particular project, I will cite. And nevertheless, this local rule of looking at your own local research area somehow gives rise to linear preferential attachment. And to my mind, the most natural mechanism to give that is this feature of local attachment plus redirection. And let me also mention one other thing that I left hanging, which was the optimal strategy for vaccination. So if you don't have enough vaccine, how should you vaccinate? You could vaccinate randomly and hope for the best. But what you really want to do is you want to vaccinate people who are very sociable, because they have more contacts and they're more likely to spread. So what you do is I pick you and I say, who's your best friend? And then I ask you, who's your best friend? And I ask everybody in this room, who's your best friend? On average, your best friend is going to be more popular than you are, on average. Because if just by that same notion that we saw in the just as we saw in that previous graph, that if you attach node randomly, and then you go to its ancestor, which is your friend, the number of attachments he has is proportional to the number of upstream neighbors. And so if when you attach to somebody randomly, the probability of going to an upstream neighbor is proportional to its degree. So that's the way that if you don't have enough vaccine, you should just vaccinate. You pick people at random and say, just tell me who your best friend is, and you vaccinate them. And so that same redirection process, I argue, may underlie this citation process. So anyways, why is linear preferential attachment so generic? I've given you some hints about why I think there is an answer. Another very powerful and interesting theme that's going on right now is the incorporation of spatial structure into these complex networks, which is, you know, another story altogether. Anyways, just to sum up this whole week, I've talked about 5 different topics, very disparate in non-equilibrium statistical physics. I try to introduce the master equation approach as a technique for solving, in general, problems in non-equilibrium statistical physics. It's a method which has not a lot of mumbo-jumbo formalism, but has a lot of powerful tools with which to analyze problems. And I hope you come away from this with at least an appreciation that non-equilibrium processes are fun, they're simple to think about, they're simple to formulate, and there's powerful tools with which to attack them. So thank you very much. I really enjoyed having you as students.
I'm glad, actually, that I got to catch the end, at least. I learned something just sitting here for a couple of minutes, which is very interesting. We hope that you've enjoyed interacting with our students, and we also hope that you'll go out into the world and promote the SCI program among your colleagues. And I have this T-shirt here, and I would like to take it and give it to your best friend.
Really, I haven't read it. If you want.